forum for frank talk about what people do for a living. Work Stew.
Hello, and welcome to Work Stew. It's May 22nd, 2013, and this is episode number 65. I'm Kate Gase Walton. I'm the editor of Work Stew, an online collection of essays and interviews in which people ponder their work lives. In this episode, I speak with forensic pathologist Dr. Judy Melanick and her husband, writer T.J. Mitchell. Together, they have written a book that will come out next year called Working Stiff: The Making of a Medical Examiner, which chronicles their journey through what they say is 2 years, three disasters, 247 autopsies, and a new baby. So I'm talking this evening with Dr. Judy Melanick and T.J. Mitchell, and the first thing we should jump into is exactly what your respective roles are. You're co-authoring a book that will come out next year. And why don't we start with the book? The name of the book is Working Stiff. And TJ, can you just give the thumbnail on what that's about?
Working Stiff is a work of narrative nonfiction, which is essentially Judy's memoir from the 2 years when she was training to become a forensic pathologist. After going to medical school and then through residency to become a pathologist, she moved to New York and we moved with her, we being me and our 1.5-year-old son, Danny. For 2 years, she trained at the New York City Office of Chief Medical Examiner to learn how to do an autopsy. That's essentially what a forensic pathologist does.
Right.
And she kept a diary the whole time, and we've turned that into a book.
And so I wanted to ask you, Dr. Melanick, when you were growing up, is a forensic pathologist as a little girl, is that what you aspired to be, or what took you down that path?
This was not at all on my radar. There should have been a point at one point when I was in third grade, my third grade teacher, Rabbi Kamlet, actually, one of his critiques of me as a student was that I did not do well with open-ended conversations in the classroom, that I always wanted to know what the answer was. Even when there wasn't an answer, he would just ask the question to have a discussion, and I could not tolerate that.
Right.
And this was his major critique of me as a student, and I figure that should have been a sign that I was going to become a forensic pathologist because my basic personality trait is that I need some sort of answer and I need to figure out how things work and what the answer is for people. So in medicine itself, my father was a doctor and he definitely inspired me to go into the field of medicine, but I didn't really have direction. I just wanted to study medicine. I love the human body and anatomy and I wanted to learn the most about it. So the decision to go into pathology was somewhat circuitous because I started off wanting to be a surgeon and then realizing that it was just too exhausting and not conducive to having a family life. So pathology was actually my default position.
Right. So that was one thing I wanted to get into because I saw that you went to medical school, it looks like, directly after your undergrad, and you were focused on surgery. And so when did it kind of dawn on you that pathology would be a good path, and was it mainly these lifestyle concerns?
Well, I had spent some time in the pathology department when I was in medical school, so there was a program called a post-sophomore fellowship in pathology, mm-hmm. where you can take a break from medical school. So after the first and second year, the first 2 years of medical school are one where they focus on the educational aspect of learning anatomy, learning physiology, just sitting in the classroom all the time. And your third and fourth years are when you do your rotations and you learn to be a doctor. So the first 2 years are really a lot more like college, and the third and fourth year are more like an apprenticeship. So between the second and third, when that natural break happens, a lot of people take a year off and do research or they travel. And I decided to do this post-sophomore fellowship in pathology because at my school at UCLA, they promoted it, and my teachers, who had taught me in the second year, were mostly pathologists, and I thought that they were just the greatest. They were the best teachers I've ever had. So I figured, let me take a year off, but not really leave medicine and just see what pathology is like. And it was actually during that time that I did research with the surgery department and fell in love with surgery. So while I was actively working in pathology, I was also doing surgery. What I didn't really comprehend was how absolutely devastating the lifestyle was. Mm. And part of it was also the program. UCLA was a really good, more what we call benign surgery program. We actually use medical terms in referring to our own programs. And I happened to match in a more malignant program where I was on call every other night. It was on the East Coast. It was very paternalistic in its attitudes. And I really started to hate doing medicine, which was horrible because I loved surgery, but they made me hate it because of the program and just the physical exhaustion aspect.
And you talked in an interview that I was listening to about how part of the process as you did your training in forensic pathology was shifting from being, I'm probably going to not characterize this exactly correctly, but from a doctor's mindset to a detective's mindset. Is that something that you can talk about a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, so much of medical school, the process of medical school is starting you to think like a physician, how to approach the human body, approach a patient, listen to their concerns and kind of filter through all the extraneous stuff that people say to focus on the stuff that a diagnosis is made out of. That's medical school. And then pathology, the training of a pathologist, which happened to me in Los Angeles at UCLA, involves doing that without a patient, but doing that by looking at tissues under a microscope, but essentially learning what the background looks like, making the library in your head of patterns that you then have to recognize so that you can figure out this is cancer and this is not cancer. That's the basic winnowing that happens in pathology. And you get so engrossed in medicine during medical school and residency that you forget how to think like a human being.
Right.
So to some degree, forensic pathology is a relearning of that BS meter that is in all of us, the street smarts that we have and that we learned as kids, just getting along on the streets of New York for me growing up,
right.
Bringing that back to the forefront and realizing that that's actually part of the diagnostic process too.
Right. That's interesting, though, because I would imagine that, you know, the deeper your training went, while there was this kind of remembering how to think like a human being, there must have also needed to be a discovery of how to approach this work in a way that set aside some pretty typical human emotions. I was reading that, you know, some of the first cases, you tell me the right words, that you worked on. I mean, these were hugely traumatic events. 9/11, you worked on, I believe, the crash of Flight 587. What was it like for you, you know, I guess fairly early then in your career, to be in those situations and have them be your workplace? You know, for the rest of us, those were huge traumas. What was it like for that to be your work?
It was a tremendous experience, and I'm grateful for it. I can't say that it was anything but harrowing, but at the same time, I'm grateful for having been through that process. The emotional aspects of it are interesting because so much of what happened to me as a doctor was I had become, to some degree, desensitized to people's pain through the process of my residency training. So when I started my forensic fellowship, I would say I was probably more desensitized and more impersonal, had more barriers up than I've had as the year unfolded. And I realized that forensics really isn't about the dead bodies. It's not about the people who died. It's about the people who are living. And that's really the narrative voice in the book, is as I start to realize that I need to come back in touch with the human aspects of what I do and how a much larger percentage of what a forensic pathologist does is that human element of talking to the families and engaging them and getting the right story sometimes. Even the detective work involves engaging the families. So that was something I had to discover over time, and I had to learn how to do that and still keep the boundaries up so I didn't bring the stuff home to my husband and my family.
TJ, what was it like to be the spouse hearing about these kinds of days at the office, and when did it dawn on both of you that turning it into a book was a real possibility and something worth doing?
Well, Judy and I met in college, and we started dating when we were 18 years old. So by the time she got to medical school, we had already been together for a long time. And when she was in residency, we had been together for a long time. So I kind of had medical school through osmosis experience with her, and had already gotten used to her coming home with all kinds of upsetting things happening. But once she started doing forensic pathology, it did take on a whole new cast. The thing that I found most interesting was she would come home and start telling a story, and the first question that I always had was, where did this happen? Mm-hmm. Like what street corner was this on that this guy got hit by a truck? And she never knew that, because not irrelevant to her, but the most important thing for her was what happened to the body. And I, as a bystander, always wanted to know, how could I prevent this happening to me or someone that I loved? So that was the first thing that I always had to overcome. And just getting used to the dinner conversation after a while, it took some time, but it happened.
Right. And you guys have young children. Is this, in fact, your dinner conversation? Do you talk in great detail about what happened at the office? How has your work, both the book and your day at the office, affected, for example, how you talk to your children about death and the things that do happen to people?
Well, just like any parent does, you have to tailor the conversation to what your kids are capable of understanding. They know what mommy does. They know that I cut up dead bodies. On the humorous end of things, they realize that when mommy says, I know someone who died that way, it's probably a good idea to stop whatever you're doing and listen to her, because she has some street cred with regards to what is safe and what is not safe.
Yeah.
Another thing that we found was it's surprisingly easy to boil it down for the kids to what the underlying cause of this person getting killed was.
Mm-hmm.
He was using drugs, and once you use drugs for a while, you have to use more and more drugs to get the same high, and he used too much drugs and it stopped his heart. Or he got shot with a gun and it put a bullet through his aorta. You can tell kids what happened without going into the details. And we don't hide things from our kids. We don't have to, really.
Right.
I mean, some of the conversations that we have, a lot of parents have been grappling with because they hear it on the news. I mean, it's in the newspaper or on the radio. So in many ways, I think that our kids have a more grounded perspective because they understand the role that I play in investigating crimes and making sure that bad people, criminals, get put in jail, because I do testify against them. But also they understand how injury happens and how to prevent it in a probably more concrete and practical sense than most kids their age.
Right.
Well, another thing they understand is most people die of heart disease. Right. And if you smoke, that's going to kill you. And if you are driving and you are breaking speed limit without a seatbelt, you could get killed. So these, the more mundane ways of dying are the things that Judy investigates more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that people have a skewed perspective about what kills people, because the unusual stuff tends to make the news, but also on the television shows like the CSIs and the Bones, they do tend to focus on the more extreme, the more prurient, the unusual. They don't show the mundane stuff that I see every day, which are the overdoses and the hangings and the motor vehicle accidents.
Right, right. And what you've just said might be the answer to this, but I'd like to ask it anyway and really ask it of both of you, which is, you know, what do you think is the least understood aspect of being a forensic pathologist or medical examiner? You know, most of us do get our images from, sad to say, the CSIs. And so, you know, what do you feel is the thing that you know, having been on the inside, either doing it or writing about it with the intensity that you have, TJ, that the rest of us just don't understand?
I think that there are several things that are definitely not reflected in the television shows and the books. The first one is the component that we have in talking to families. And this is something that was emphasized in my training in New York City, which is not done in many offices, but in New York, we were taught to engage the families, to call them, to give them feedback from what we found at the autopsy, and also ask questions to get more medical history. So we do develop a phone relationship in most cases with the families of the deceased, and that's rarely, if ever, seen on TV. I think Dr. G, Medical Examiner, on the Discovery Channel is the only one who ever shows that. Mm-hmm. And the other aspect that tends to be missing from the television shows is everything seems to be resolved at the point that the criminal is caught. And really, first of all, most of what we investigate are not homicides. We investigate natural deaths and suicides and accidents, and that's really, the homicides are a minority of the deaths we investigate. And when we do investigate them, a big aspect of what we do is testify in court. So being an expert witness, being able to explain the science in terms that a jury can understand and then use as the basis for making a decision for guilt or innocence, that's a really essential part of what we do. And I don't think I've ever seen a forensic pathologist testify in court on television in one of those shows, because usually the arc of the narrative ends when the criminal is put in jail.
Right.
And related to that, the fact that court testimony is a big part of Judy's job. Judy is a civil servant. Mm-hmm. All coroner systems and medical examiner systems are part of usually county government, sometimes state government, but she works for you. She is mm-hmm. your tax dollars at work. And that's something that very few people understand. People are always asking her, which hospital do you work at? She doesn't. She works for the people of a democracy. It's an important part of running a state is figuring out why people die when they shouldn't.
It's a public interest.
Right. That is a really interesting clarification. So, and then I saw that there's also, so is it a private practice in addition that you have pathologyexpert.com? Can you talk about what that does?
Sure. So as a forensic pathologist, one construct, one ability to work is in for a county or a city government. And then another way of earning money or making a living is working as a medical legal consultant. So for the past 9 years, I was working for the San Francisco Medical Examiner's Office. I recently switched and I'm now working for the Oakland Coroner's Office. So I still have my full occupation of performing autopsies in the public service to figure out why people died for a county system, now in Alameda. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, I have my private practice where families who are unhappy with the autopsy results that they got from somewhere, or a family who wants an autopsy that didn't get one, or sometimes attorneys, more often the clients are attorneys, who have a lawsuit where someone has died, and it's usually a wrongful death action if it's a civil case, or if it's a criminal case, they're defense attorneys, they want an opinion, either a primary opinion or a secondary opinion about the cause of death. So they need someone who's skilled in reviewing the autopsy report, the photos, the scene investigation information, and microscopic slides, and then also capable of writing an opinion and testifying to it in court.
Are you able to distill what it is about the work, whether it's in, you know, as a public servant or in your private practice, that, you know, it's very clear what you are giving, I think, to these families and to the public. What do you get from your work? Where do you derive the satisfaction that you clearly seem to have in it?
The first level of satisfaction comes with being able to give someone closure. And I didn't quite understand that myself until recently in reviewing my own father's death, in part for the book. I understand that when my father died, I was 13 years old, and he committed suicide. So he was actually a coroner's case. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the aspect of my history that makes it important to me to reach out to the families and talk to them and give them an understanding about what happened. Because when someone dies, they may have even died in a hospital and you've had lots of doctors attending to them, but it's still a shock. Mm. And nobody really understands why, unless they're physicians themselves. And even in some cases, even when they are physicians, there's always this not knowing until you have someone who does an autopsy and gives you the answers. So this is where being the answer person, being the one that can give someone closure and answer those questions is very important to me. And it gives me a lot of satisfaction in my work. That's the part that I would do even if I wasn't getting paid, is that it gives me great joy, is being able to move someone along in their grief from denial toward anger, or from anger toward acceptance, a little bit more in that direction.
Yes.
So that they can find closure in the death and move on in their grieving process.
Interesting. And so the book is due out next year, and people can find information about it by going to its Facebook page, which is called Dr. Working Stiff. And they should like it. And was it also optioned? Am I getting ahead of myself here? Was it optioned for TV?
Yeah, there's a television option, and we'll know about that next year, whether it's going to be a dramatic series for television or not. But it certainly will be published by Scribner in August of 2014.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to that. Thank you both so much for talking to me. This has been fascinating. I really could pepper you with questions all evening, but I will let you get back to your kids. And thank you again.
That wraps up the interview for today. Thanks again very much to my guests, TJ Mitchell and Dr. Judy Melanick. Thanks also to everyone who's written an essay for Work Stew. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening today. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks, and I hope you'll check it out. In the meantime, please let me know what you thought of the interview by sending an email to kate@workstew.com, by posting a comment on the WorkStew website, or by writing a review for iTunes. Thanks again, and bye for now.